was
Gary Studebaker.
Laos in 1963 to 1965.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we have a couple of biographical questions I always ask, and then we can actually start talking, which is you were born in?
In Ohio.
In Ohio. Anywhere in particular?
Marysville, Ohio.
Marysville, Ohio.
North of Columbus in 40, and then worked my way out to California.
Great. And you were... Let's see, now I wanted to ask you that. Now I've forgotten all those wonderful questions that I wanted to start the tape when we started talking about. But let's just move on, and I'm sure we're going to come across them as we go. What does your family do in Marysville?
Well, we grew up on a farm. Our family moved to about four or five different farms in my early childhood. Basically, then when I was 6 years old, we ended up in just north of Dayton, Ohio, where the family farm still is. And so we grew up as farm people. We're a farm family, Church of the Brethren. I guess the main message that I got in my early childhood was, like many people, see if there's something out there that you can do that, not necessarily for yourself, but to help other people. Ended up going to Laos, and of course, like I said in my paper that I sent to you, I got more out of it than the Laotians did. Mm-hmm. As far as what good did I do over there, I feel good about it because it was an effort to learn about the world that I lived in, the environment, and just to make a long story short, I think the friendships that I established was probably one of the things that was that I could do. Speaking the Lao language probably helped. You know about that, and that probably helped. And I enjoyed it.
You were growing up, you were growing up on a family farm. In other words, you went to high school in Dayton.
I went to high school just north of Dayton, a small town called West Milton.
Mm-hmm. And when did you first hear about the IVS?
I was at going to college in Manchester in Indiana in 63. That's when I heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this is something that they're looking for recruits shortly after Peace Corps. Yeah, that's what I wanted to do.
Well, who's they?
I think it was, the word had somehow gotten around a gentleman by the name of Norman Brockmuller from IVS, and going around recruiting at the various colleges. And I got wind, hey, there's an IVS person. I've heard of IVS. Like a pretty good deal. I can go to Southeast Asia.
Just like that.
Yeah.
What made you want to leave the farm and see the lights of Paris?
I wanted to get the heck off of the farm. there must be something better out there. Huh. And didn't really want to be a farmer. I enjoyed the life, but there's more exciting things to do in this life.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
There were eight in our family, and I was sixth. And couple of brothers also went into volunteer service. There's a thing called Brethren Volunteer Service. That's a church, and they send people various parts of the United States or overseas, and he went to Morocco through that project, my older brother. I came along, went to Laos, and then my young brother under me went to Vietnam at a Church World Service. So the volunteer thing was kind of that mode of the day, I'd say, in the early 60s there. Kennedy was president and that kind of thing. So, but I think I'd have done it without even the political scene as it was. Yeah, it's just something that,
Well, had your older brother already gone into volunteer service before you heard about IVS at college?
Yes, I didn't hear about IVS until, maybe a couple years before I joined up.
Mm-hmm. And that the knowing about IVS largely came because at college there was a legacy that a recruiter had passed through and people knew about it. And
yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I just did you see it on a bulletin board or did a friend tell
you? I think my brother was, he knew about volunteerism, shall I say.
Right.
And so he came back from Morocco. He was working on his earthquake relief. They had a big earthquake in Agadir in late 50s. And he knew about a few volunteer things. And you ever hear about IVS, Gary? I think that kind of thing. And then shortly after that, this IVS recruiter came.
Mm-hmm.
So I was feeling pretty good about that. That particular, knowing that, I get to go to Laos and that kind of thing. So it sounded really exciting to me.
Well, after you heard about the recruiter, and did you go to a meeting with the recruiter?
Yes. He came to us first. I just was my senior year at college. I was a PE major, and I was going to go out and teach, I suspect. But I knew that I wanted to do something in the way of volunteer. And this was the perfecto thing, so it looked just right. And,
well, the draft was still in operation. Did that have any impact at all? I mean, I don't mean as a motivation, but how did that kind of fit in?
No, you know, even before the draft, I grew up in this church called Church of the Brethren, and they were alternative service was what I grew up. It was a peace church like the Friends Church, the Quakers, the Church of the Brethren, and the Mennonites. Those are the three mainline churches, I guess, and that have a peace posture. By that, peace, fine, but what are you going to do about it was the question. Are you going to do something about it? So that message got through to me, and to do, not that I did great things for peace, but I enjoyed the overseas experience, shall I say, speaking the Laotian language. Probably that was the most important thing that I probably could have done, to speak Lao. I did speak it, learned it, and was able to talk to the people. I was surprised I was able to learn that language in 6 months and start getting by. And certainly by the end of my 2 years, I was definitely speaking. I was speaking to them after 6 months, but just kept growing in that language. And that sounded really good to me. Yeah.
Well, when you after you met the recruiter at college, and you decided this is what you wanted to do, did you were you summoned to an orientation in Washington? How did that work?
Well, let's see, because I was senior year in college, and so the recruiter came. He said, "I had 2 months before graduation was on the docket. I had already written them ahead of time, and since I'd heard about it, before the recruiter got there, I'd say my brother Ron informed me, and then the recruiter came. That's when I really learned about it. So then, yes, I went to upon graduation, went to Washington D.C., and I think IBS was collecting us all at George Washington University there. And as I recall, it was New York, or was it Washington? Yeah, Washington D.C. Yeah, Washington D.C. George Washington University had an orientation. Some of the people in IBS were there talking to us. And, at that time, we knew within 4 or 5 days we were going to board a plane and head for Southeast Asia. So
did you have to write a letter to your draft board telling them that you were going to exercise this?
At my draft board, I was, I forget what the status was, but it was alternative service is what they call it, and stated to them when I was 18 years old,
right.
I guess when you had to sign
registered,
up, that I registered, what do they call it, 1-0, I think that's what it was called. And they didn't give me a hard time. I understand that happens sometimes. I just told them that I'd like to do alternative service. I don't want to sit or nothing.
Well, being from that area and identifying yourself as a member of that faith.
Right,
probably.
Yeah. And that had something to do with, I suspect, because on my paper that I... As I think back all those many years back when I was 18 years old, you did have to make a statement and kind of like verify why it is you believe the way you do about in the Peace Church. And I had done a few things with regarding, not too much, but I wasn't very active as far as, I was very active in the church, but as far as going out doing peace things as a teenager, I never did that. But I saw my life down the road as possibly wanting to... head in that direction. That was what I was taught all my life, I guess you could say, Church of the Brethren.
Mm-hmm.
So those things were written on that paper, I suspect, and that's what they saw.
No, it's just, I have to pick up on, I am from California, but I have to pick up on the pollen or whatever it is that we've got, because I'm used to
the
garbage
the
we get in Atlanta. So you got on a plane. But what do you remember? What month? What time of the season?
I would say it was in September. I left. I spent my whole summer. I graduated in probably May from college, June, July, August. I went to this place in New Windsor, Maryland, called it's a Church of the Brethren training center. When they send their BVSers, what they call Brethren Volunteer Service Workers, out throughout the United States. These are volunteers also. Well, I want to get their training, not necessarily their training, but it looked like a pretty good thing to do. See how they train people to do service type things all around the world here in the United States. They had several speakers, and basically, I'd say the main topic was teaching people if it's possible to teach this service in the kind of world we live in, you know. And, probably wasn't too many things that I hadn't already learned in church, I suspect, or getting around as I did, not too much eye-opening, I should say. It's common stuff, I guess. So that's where I, then September, that's when I went to Washington, got the train, George Washington. Basically, the train was just to tell us what IVS is and what it's like, what their history was. I think they'd been about 12, 14 years old at that time. I forget the early history of IVS. So their budget, and they work under USAID, or at least Agency for International Development, a few things like that. In the meantime, I'd been studying Laos pretty good and wasn't acquainted with it at the time. So.
Did they bring any academics in to talk to you, or they were all IVS people, but people had just come back from service?
As I recall, they were pretty much all IVS. Mm-hmm. Just giving us a lowdown. I forget the director's name at that time. It's changed a few times since, mm-hmm. but Don Luce is now. But it was awfully exciting to me. As I recall, there were about 40 people in my group. Jeez, I think some were going to Vietnam, some were going to Cambodia, some were going to Laos. I think it's probably split up pretty even, men, women. I'd say 50-50 as I look at that picture now. And, we went, took off from Chicago, went up to Alaska, down to Japan, and down on into, Phnom Penh is what it was, Saigon, dropping people off all along the way, and I ended up in Laos then. I went to Hong Kong somewhere, I guess it's after Japan probably, and then on into Laos. The first 6 weeks in Laos was spent getting training in Laos. Had a Laotian who had been working for IVS as a, kind of an interpreter, and he gave us some training. I didn't really understand too much of the political picture over there, other than that there was the royal Lao soldiers that were under the Americans were giving them training, and then there was the communist Lao, the Pathet Lao. That's about all I knew. So I ended up and after I got done in Vientiane with that 6 weeks training, then was, am I talking about the right thing you want to hear here? Then I went down to Kong Island, mm-hmm. and I spent my first, I'd say, 6 months on Kong Island, which is the largest island on the Mekong River. Mm-hmm. It's right at the border of Cambodia and Laos, at the bottom of Laos there. And that's about how it went there. Then the next 18 months I was up on the what they call the Bulavans Plateau up on a little town called Hui Kong was the name of it. It's been so long, I hardly remember. But Hui Kong was the name of it. Mainly my job was, I came over as a farm person, and thinking possibly I can do something with regards to farming over there. So I had I worked directly under a United States Agency for International Development person, a USAID person, George Penrose, I believe was his name, from Portland, Oregon. Nice guy, and nice to work with, and even though we had IVS team leaders and people that would come down to visit us at Kong Island or Hui Kong up on the hill, mainly USAID was in charge of us. They'd give us our supplies. I rather enjoyed the relationship. I don't know about the other IVSers. I thought it was an okay relationship. They'd give us projects. One time we introduced some hogs. They all died. They got this, they started out with this disease in the ear of worms, which I know about that because we've had hogs got that same disease back in Ohio. But we were able to remedy the problem with medicines. We just could not get a handle on them. All the hogs died. But they did have pigs before they died. I shouldn't say they all died, because there was some left when I had to leave at the end of 2 years, and I kind of would like to know whatever happened to those hogs. Then we were starting a fish project. I must say, I don't know a thing about fishing. I fished. So there were fish that could live in we had a creek going right in front of our house. Mm-hmm. By the way, we helped build the bridge that went across that creek with USAID. So we did many things. That was one. But we turned that creek into a fishing pond, a little fishing pond, I should say. It wasn't big enough to call it a lake. It was a pond. And they declared, our own USAID people, that there was a fish out there. Most of the stuff we were getting from Thailand, because Thailand seemed, that's where we got the hogs from. They got the healthy hogs. And you've seen the slope back, how do you call those hogs in Laos? They're just tiny, reminds me of Ohio pigs. Slope back, big fat hogs, but only about 12 inches off the ground. Mm-hmm. Ohio, we were raising the same thing, about 2 feet off the ground. It was all very interesting to me to see all these kinds of things happening. But anyway, getting on to the fish pond, starting to dig for the fish pond. About that time I had to leave. Unfortunately, that's another project I would have liked to have seen the end, but went back home at the end of that project. There were many, many experimenting with just different crops of corn, mostly. And as I recall, one of the crops was tapioca. I'm used to raising corn. I've never raised tapioca, but it was all fun and it was all very interesting to me. Let me shut
this
okay.
up.
And
We're a little closer to you.
Oh yeah.
I'll put it right there.
Yeah. And you know what? We can put that thing right up here in front of the boys.
Terrific.
Okay. One of my projects was what they call a water seal latrine. I poured cement before and poured molds and stuff, but I've never hadn't poured a water seal latrine. These projects didn't phase me as far as, gee, I can't do this, why are they asking me to do it? I figured that's my job. I need to do whatever these people who are, they had some expertise, the USAID and the people, and it didn't bother me. I figured this is something I need to, if I don't know, they'll teach me, which of course they did. And so we went around putting in water seal latrines, and I remember how proud the people were to get their water seal latrine instead of going out in the jungle and relieving themselves. Now they could do it properly, and the sanitation-wise, everything was kosher and in order. So that was kind of fun. That's what I recall. Another project that we did, it was kind of nice. It was a water wheel. We were trying to teach them how to. They carry their water over their shoulders, which is fine, and nothing wrong with this. And I tell you, all the time I was doing these projects, we happened to think, I wonder what these people think of us. Here we are, young guy just out of college, coming over here and showing them some projects. And I wonder, all these many years, I wonder what they must be thinking of us. Is in fact what they're doing better than us? I mean, hey, they've been doing this thousands of years, carrying water the same way. Here we're trying to show them how to build a water wheel. And at that, a water wheel that will, once it breaks, they can fix. So we built one out of about the only thing that we had to get that they would never have access to was a steel, shall I say, axle. But the rest was built out of bamboo. And so that worked. It worked. We had a difficult time getting it going at first, but with a few IVS heads, and like anybody else, it comes together. And so the IVS, they can figure out a way to make the water channel in closer, get a little more force going down on the old paddles, get that thing going. It actually did work. And
what was the power used for?
To raise water, I'd probably raise it up 20 feet in the air. It was a big water wheel. Raise it up, I'd say, about 20 feet. And it channeled water after it got to the top in bamboo troughs that the villagers helped make. We worked on it together to a giant truck patch, shall I say. We call it a truck patch in Ohio, but garden,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. So that was one project. Just one of many. The other thing we did, there was a project over there called United States Information Service, USIS. And they were in the same building in Pakse, which was the capital of southern Laos, or the big city down there. And as USAID, USIS and USAID seemed to be under the same umbrella there. And they tried to educate the Laotians. And they'd send us movie upon movie, many movies. We had a gasoline generator. And we'd go out and show movies. how to make pottery.
Was this on both places, or on Kong Island?
Yeah, this was both places. We did it both places. And old pottery making, how to make bricks. Realizing that these people had already been making bricks, but that's fine. Hey, maybe there's a new baby or a new one coming along who can still learn this. And I'm sure, I believe that the IDS people surely took signals from the people there. I mean, it looked to me like everything was kosher, and I think we were showing them the right thing. I mean, just being there 2 years, it looked like it was the proper thing to do. I mean, there was also entertainment involved. I mean, the Laotians are into drama, you know, the dance, and they were acting out drama. And so USIS recorded some of this on their reels. And it's not like video today, but it's the big old reels and the projector. So we went out many times putting this stuff on elephants, because we'd try to reach another village looking at the map that was distant. Okay, so we put on the elephant and get up there with all this stuff and truck out. And at times there were soldiers that guarded. There were soldiers under our house, Royal Lao soldiers. And they'd you know, lead the way and so-called protect us on our way. Got about two soldiers ahead of the elephant and maybe one behind. So that's the way it was. It was all very interesting to me, though. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and especially I found the people were receptive. You know, the Laotians, I found them receptive. That's my, at least my picture of it. And as I look back, gee, I've never been asked to talk about that too much before, but I enjoyed it now as I look back and think back about that project. As far as what good I did, I can't really say that. And I didn't expect to before I went over. I like to think I'm mature enough to know that when I was 23 and left for Laos. But I don't think I would say I didn't change anybody's mind or improve their condition, nor did I, upon going, think that I was going to do that. You know, I'd read about Tom Dooley. He'd been in Laos and doing his medical kinds of things. But I like to think everything, you know, I wasn't a rebel. I mean, I think everybody was trying to do what they thought was right. Sure, there was waste a little bit. I mean, I walked into the USAID compound where we have, it seemed like many, a sea of secretaries. I'm not sure what they were typing up there in Vietnam, Americans. But I didn't question it. I guess I was young and didn't know to question or ask, what are you people doing here? And I know there were projects that the Americans were doing. I mean, they were building bridges. There was this thing called Public Works under the USAID umbrella, and I know they were going around building bridges. One of the things Public Works did was come down to Hue Kong, where I was, and they were just building a school down there. So, I think the American government was trying to win over their friendship, and I think they probably thought we're trying to do the right thing. Well, one thing I noticed about the culture, and I learned this too, is when you get down there out in the village, you do as the Laotians do, and they squat, you squat. They talk about certain things, you use the same language and talk the same way. I guess it's, and I realized this when I was down there, oh, we're doing the same thing they're doing. And Not that it was bad. I didn't have any value judgment whether it was good or bad. It just seemed right. And I guess that's the way life is. We adapt and do as the Laotians do. That's one of the things that I felt that I learned.
So if someone said that some theoretical applications for you to respond to, first of all, it would seem that people who you seem to have engaged in this as a matter of course, you had very low expectations in terms of, you know, you weren't going to conquer the world.
Right.
You were going to save the Lao for Christianity.
No,
That if anything would happen, you'd probably mature and develop a broader experience for yourself and perhaps find the next thing that you were going to do as a result mm-hmm. of whatever maturing event mm-hmm. that took place. Mm-hmm. And so when you saw things that might look political, you found them amusing or distant. You know, you weren't necessarily.
I think that's where I came in. You know, I mean, I didn't have any axes to grind. To me, it was like, this is really an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going around the world, you guys. I mean, I wasn't going around telling people that, mm-hmm. but I was telling myself that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to even see Japan. You know, one day it might be, but I'm going to see Japan.
Well, you were usually paired with someone. Who was your partner?
Well, it's down on Kong Island. Mm-hmm. It was a guy by the name of John Steele from Dubuque, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And worked out real nice. I found all these guys to be very acceptable. And, you know, I think we probably all come from a little different backgrounds, but I found it to be a workable relationship. You know, he was the team leader. That was fine with me. He'd been there longer, and he kind of gave a few signals, you know, that he received to help get me oriented when I got there to Kong Island. Let's see. And then after 6 months in Kong Island, I went up, by the way, another project in Kong Island, I think about Kong Island, we went around, somebody had the idea, it seemed we'd get ideas, and we just go do them. I hope they were thought out. It seemed to me like the appropriate thing. We took a survey. How many of you people do farming? Matter of fact, I even forget what the survey was about now, but had to do with how many people, where you get your food, be at the Mekong River, you know. I'm not sure exactly. There was objectives to that. I'm not sure I can recall what they all were. It probably had to do with delivery of service. Do you have hogs? What's your steady supply of meat? Things like that. But fish, hogs, chickens. I guess they're trying to maybe figure out, is there anything of a scarcity that possibly might turn into a project for IBS? So that was one survey that we did down there.
Who was your partner up on the hill?
Up on the hill, yeah. It was a guy by the name of Wynn McKeithen from Connecticut, and I guess he was the team leader. There's one other gentleman there, and I forget these guys' names now.
No, it's actually mm-hmm. quite common mm-hmm. 30 years ago. You can remember some of the people you went to high school with, but
right.
not everybody.
That's it.
It's about that same time period.
Yeah. But up on the hill, mm-hmm. That's where we moved into a little bit more, shall I say, we saw a few more troops. Now, Kong Island, I don't recall too many troops other than the troops that were there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just they seemed to be friendly and on our side, but if they were on the other side, I wouldn't have known it, and I don't think my IVS buddies would have known it either. You know, they just kind of lived in the village, and they put on their khakis and each day and toted that carbine around, and we didn't know what they were doing. We figured they were on the Royal, a part of the Royal Air Force or Army. So, but they treated us nice. We sat around the rice wine jugs not each evening, but many evenings, sucking on the old rice wine with the soldiers, and those are the same soldiers that guarded our house, and one of the soldiers even cooked our food for us. And
so that's an interesting question about your supplies.
Uh-huh.
I would imagine if you went out into the village and bought an egg every day, that would probably be the end of the economy in the village. So Did you, was this commissaried into you, the food
right,
and
it was.
You?
It was flown into us. We had a pipeline, the milk run, we called it, came from Vientiane to Pak Se, I suspect, if not every day, almost every day, with supplies, because there were a lot of Americans down there in Pak Se, and just doing USAID kinds of things, public works and all that, and what they call, we call them RO, requirements office. I later figured out that that was a CIA. So these people that were working out of the requirements office, we put our heads together, the IPSers, and those are CIA guys. So basically,
what made you think that?
Supplied us with, in case we ever needed to escape, they supplied us with guns, and which I took, and a two-way radio, just in case we ever needed to, you know, we're in trouble. And, so they were in charge. I remember one time they shipped in our choppers, the American choppers, shipped in a big supply of ammunition.
This is on Kong Island, or?
No, this was up on Hui Kong. Yeah, because that's where most of the troop movement
right,
was.
Right.
Every now and then we'd see our troops. I assume they were our troops. They were the villagers going through our village, coming and going in long streams. One time there was a stream of about 50 of them trucking around with these big bazookas over their shoulders. These were troops moving through the village, and I don't recall ever. I think one time we had to leave our site, which was down there up on the hill at the Bulletin's Plateau at Hui Kong. The USAID people called us and said, "You better get out of there."
On the radio?
Yeah, on the radio. So they sent planes up and shuttled us out, and we were back the next day, and that was the only time.
Was there already a little airstrip when you?
Yeah, there was an airstrip when I got there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I first flew into Hui Kong, you look down in this jungle, and there's a clearing, and so they let me out and took off, and there I was. I didn't know which way to go, but there was an American missionary right there on the airstrip, and he said, "Whoop, down there, there's your IBS house across that creek." That's where I went, and that's where I was for 18 months then, before I left.
So your partner just didn't happen to be there to meet you?
He didn't happen to be there to meet me. Yeah.
I've had experiences like that. I know what that's like. I just generally followed the other people in the other vehicles that met whoever else was there, and just went in the same general direction.
Yeah, another enjoyable part about this gets back to customs. And, you know, you're driving through the village in the Jeep, and things that we're not used to as Americans. And these villagers, I used to be able to do it. I don't know whether I can do it now, but they'd get down like this, and they'd squat on all fours. And I'm doing it.
Yeah,
now.
You're doing it pretty good.
And that's how they'd be. That's how that was their chair. Uh-huh. And I was better at it then than I am now. But
That you can do it now is remarkable. Yeah. Unfortunately, I played high school football.
Oh yeah.
And the result of that is I can't do anything at all with my knees. And in fact, this is why I like sitting on the floor a lot.
Yeah, I've got a knee problem too from skiing. But that was, you know, and you know, I as I said, once in Laos, you do as the Laotians do. They saluted me. They clicked their heels when I walked by or drove by. And, you know, not that I feel I need to be, people need to humble themselves to me or anything, but I did what I felt was right. I saluted them back. And said hello to them, things like that. And, I remember... one time, see, they'd always give we Americans first shot at the food and choice at everything, and I respect their values, so I went along with it, even though it didn't set with me that they had this feast and all of a sudden, my buddy and I, Brian, one of my buddies up on the hill, O'Connor was his name, Brian O'Connor. They say, okay, it's time to eat. Okay, you two, you go in and eat. Okay, we'd go in and eat, and they'd shut the door. We'd been there with this big feast of food all over the place, and we'd look out over the door, and there were the people out there just waiting till we got done, then they'd eat. And now it seems funny, and it was funny at the time, but we would not show our laughter to those people. Mm-hmm. We just did as they felt was proper. And I just wanted to, that was one of the things. Very Laotians. I think this is true because I've been to Cambodia and Vietnam several times, and I just find the Laotians to be that humility type of, at least those hill tribers. I was in the hill tribe of what they called Nhiều Hơn and La Ven. And they all had that kind of, I guess you could call it a respect for, I don't know whether it was the white man or the American or what, but the French, there was a French missionary, a Catholic missionary in that village too, and he got the same treatment. Of course, the Catholic missionary was doing kind of the same type of thing I'd say IBS was doing. He was showing them as best he could agricultural kinds of things with plants and that kind of thing. So,
well, what kind of agriculture were the Laotians engaged in?
Their main food supply were the chickens. They never went hungry, and all that time I was there, I never saw any Lao go hungry. It seemed that they could propagate chickens very plentifully. And then if they wanted to go down to the kind of like a creek and turn into a river, they could go fishing, had plenty of fish. They had crossbows, they could go out and shoot, these barking deer. We'd hear these, when I first got there, I heard this barking sound. Soon learned that they got deer that bark like a dog, but the meat's very tender because I had some. So they'd go out and shoot these barking deer, and there's various fowl and birds that they could shoot with the crossbow, and they'd set traps for the fish in the Mekong River, and I don't think they ate the water buffalo. They might have. I don't recall. That would be a very tender meat. But they had hogs also.
When they had if there was a feast, a wedding, or a holiday, what kind of food would people eat for those? Everything.
Everything. they had these baskets, just like we're sitting on the floor here. They'd have these big old rice baskets, about 3.5 feet wide, some bigger. They sit right on the floor, but they were clean on the top where they put the sticky rice. So the rice would be piled up, 6 inches high in that big basket. And around the side of the basket, all the way around, they'd have fish. Seems to me it'd mostly be fish. And or chicken. Yeah, chicken around there too. Like I said, it had plenty of chicken. And hogs, they'd butcher hogs. And I called them hogs. The pigs, I suspect, more like, because they weren't nearly as high as the hogs I recall in Ohio. So they'd butcher the hogs, and they'd had just hog, fish, chicken, rice. And they'd also make a delicious soup. And I'll tell you, since I've been back to the States, I got back in 65. I was only there 2 years, 63 to 65. I've never tasted a soup more delicious than the soup that they served in the Hill Tribe Laotian country. I don't know how they spiced it up, but they went out and got some spices out there that were really good. And so they just heat this stuff, the soup or whatever it was, or cook their meat over an open fire like we'd go camping. That's how they did it. Now in the house even too, they'd have a way to release some of the smoke, I guess, and sometimes in the house, although you notice when you go in their houses, they were kind of dark. Naturally, you wouldn't want too many windows because it rained so much over there. And but you saw black smoke a little bit in the house, so they'd do a little cooking. But
hogs. The houses were all on stilts, most of, as I recall, simply because it was kind of muddy there when it rained. They let the hogs run under the house. That way they'd throw the scraps out to them. So,
what did you do during the rainy season?
Well, it seemed like we could always go out every day, even if it was in the rain. We'd go out and do something. I'm not sure what we did.
But I remember filling a lot of sandbags. Right. And that's about it.
But the feasts were something tremendous. I mean, they invited us to marriages in the Hill Tribe, marriages that take place. And, you know, it wasn't like our marriages here. We'd go to the Methodist Church or whatever and spend the from the wedding starts at noon and the reception's over at 6 or 7 in the evening. These ceremonies would go all day and all night. And so they'd spend a good while at the, and it'd be dancing. They'd have their various, one of the instruments made out of bamboo was called a can, and you get this nice bamboo sound that we got used to, and they'd pass around the rice wine. You'd take a slug and stiffen up for the next one if they'd bring 3 or 4 around. And I think they called it Lao Hai, as I remember. It was like liquor, and it had a pretty good sting going down. It'd give it to you in a shot glass. And then they'd be dancing all the time this was going on. They'd have this cymbal-like music and the cans playing this Laotian music. And you'd just be sitting there talking or getting up and dancing with one of the Laotian girls, or if it looked like there was somebody there to dance with. And the bride and groom all the time were in the midst, and they'd put on these, they'd have the village, chief, I guess he was called, and or the medicine man also, he was kind of high up there too, and they'd come around with these, like you go to Thrifty and buy these, this cord or this rope that's not a rope, but it's more like string, only thick string, and they'd wrap three or four wraps around your wrist, and they'd tie it real good. And it was called a bossi. We're going to have a bossi, B-A-C-C-I, as I think is how they spelled it. And as I think back, the village chief and the medicine man, I guess you could call him, one or the other, or both maybe, I think I've got this right, from what I saw, they put this around the bride and groom's wrist separately. I mean, they didn't tie their hands together, but separately on your wrist like a bracelet. And then they twist the little, where you tie it off, and there's a little cord coming up where you cut it. They kind of twist that and say little, things that would bring, so to speak, good luck to the bride and groom. That's what they did. And all the time, a lot of people sitting around squatting and eating rice and hearing the music and dancing. And if they'd run out of food, why, somebody would run over, catch another hog, put it on the stump. They had a place where they butchered hogs. Take their knife, slit its throat, let all the blood come out in it. They'd save the blood. Then they'd pass the blood around for us all to drink. But I never saw any American drink that blood, but they sure did, and they thought it was good. And so that was like the parties, how the parties were. I think of another thing, when I think of eating habits, is when the soldiers that guarded our house, I have to kind of make my mind go back, because I've never brought this subject up very much. I teach school here for LA Unified School District. Mm-hmm. And every now and then I bring this subject up. I teach junior hires, and I like to see how they squirm. But in our house in Hui Kong up on the hill, it was raining really hard. Many times this would happen. And so the soldiers under our house that were guarding our house, or supposedly guarding our house at night, we had a lantern hanging. Since there was no electricity, we just had one of these kind of lanterns that you put kerosene in and pump it, and you got this kind of a bright glow coming from this little, forget what that shield-like thing was that you put on there to make it glow. But anyway, we hung the lantern, and as typically, we'd be playing cards, euchre or something over there. And so the soldiers would come up, and sometimes they'd get into card games with us, but the soldiers really liked the lamp, and after a rain, all the fireflies would be flying around. So they'd get a big old basin of water and stick it under the lamp. We'd still be playing cards around the basin. We knew what they were going to do because we'd seen it many times. The fireflies would hit the water. The soldiers would all stand around, pull them up one by one, peel off the wings, and pop them in their mouth and eat them, and eat the fireflies. So that was one of their customs. It was kind of interesting. Another time, this was on Kong Island. We lived in another house up on stilts and everything. And one time we had a little Chinese boy come up and just visit with us. And he was on our, had a porch. And we were sitting out on our front porch one evening listening to some music out in the village that they were having. No, not radio music or anything like that. Mm-hmm. They made their own music. I don't recall any radios at all in those places where I was, except we had a radio. This little boy, there was a locust. It was probably as big as your thumb, hopping around. And of course, you know what I'm gonna say. He ended up eating the thing. It got behind our couch here up on the porch, and he had us move the couch. He finally caught it, picked it up, peeled the wings off, and I don't think this is unusual from what the other people who live there in the village do. This little boy happened to be a Chinese, little Chinese boy, and I've seen the other kids do this too. But he peeled the wings off, popped it in his mouth, and then he went from side to side with it, like that, and pretty soon we heard him crunch it slowly, and he finally ended up eating that whole thing. So that's another story I wanted to tell. So we had also at our access a motorboat, which we used down there on Kong Island to get on the Mekong, which seemed forever to get across. It was very wide down there at the border of Cambodia and Laos. And go across to other villages to show movies and things like that, as I recall, for USAID.
Well, were the movies you took around to show these Laotians, these were about Laos.
Right, yeah. Yes. They were, I would say you could call them educational, cultural, mainly. They had showed them about Lao drama that they liked. This would be probably comparable to us going to the movies. Mm-hmm. I believe it was in Vientiane, where they have drama groups up there that put on various drama that are recorded by, I suspect, USAID. Put on the, mm-hmm. So we can go out and show the villagers this, and they just really enjoyed that. In the meantime, while we're showing movies, people would be coming with well equipped to, like we'd go camping, that people would be around, be setting up a little fire and cooking their food, and like us having popcorn at the mm-hmm. movies, they'd have chicken and whatever they could roast over the fire. And it just turned into a pretty big. Very nice gathering. I mean, I don't recall any carousing or fighting going on or anything like that. The people just learned to cooperate, and you know, the movies were free, and it was. And we'd sleep that night. If it was too far to get back to the village, we'd sleep that night. As I recall, somebody's house, maybe the village chief's house, or seemed like in almost every town there was a place you could. For visitors just to rest, kind of a little house that was, I know a couple of villages I went to, just a little house for even their own villagers if they wanted to rest. It seems to me I recall resting at one of these places.
And, ever run into George Daly?
No, I don't recall
that.
You
might have left just before, about that time.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was a little further north.
North, uh-huh, yeah.
But and when, I'm just trying to see where to, was there, did you have any impression at all about the French involvement in Indochina? Was there anything other than like architecture in the cities? Was there anything
architecture
other than that?
Yeah, I saw the French architecture, some of the buildings there. And a few French still live there, in Vientiane at least. I didn't see, like I said, there was this one French missionary that lived way out there in the sticks where we did, in among the Nyohun and La Van up in this village. But and we did see a few French people. No, I didn't pick up too much of the flavor of the French, other than that the villagers were, a few people I talked to were aware that the French were in Indochina, they were in Laos, and they were aware that the French were there, and no longer not so many. They now know that more Americans are there. I'm not sure they knew why, but at least in the Hill Tribe. I spent most of my time with the Hill Tribes, and that's where I learned to speak most of my language, being out there with them. Mm-hmm. As far as the language, I don't feel I learned those 6 weeks quite as much in that formal training as I did right out in Kong, on Kong Island and Hui Kong. And the reason I think that is probably, as we all know, getting out there speaking and swimming or sinking, I had a little notebook that I kept with me. And any time there was a new word or phrase that came up, I wrote it down, or thing that I wanted, what time is it? And we always had an interpreter among the two of us there. Oh, he'd tell me that. And there's many a night I would sit on that back porch when I first got over there in on Kong Island, or up on Hui Kong's, mostly Kong Island, first got there, and quiz him, okay, what is the word for time to eat? That kind of thing. He'd say that, he'd tell me, and I'd write it down the way I phonetically thought it sounded. And that's how I learned the language. And for me, I think it worked. That seemed to be the best for me, and I try to use those phrases with the people. The rice that they grew in the lowlands was rice paddy. And in the highlands, I was surprised to learn that you can grow rice outside the water, up just on hills, like we grow wheat. So, at least up in the hills, they didn't have the rice paddies. It was a little different method. That was interesting to me. Occasionally, we'd get some R&R. I forget what it was, but I suspect we got 21 days a year or something like that. Mm-hmm. Hong Kong looked pretty promising, so I like all the other Americans over there, they enjoyed going shopping. You get these free milk runs to Hong Kong, so it seemed that the planes probably went off, I suspect, every day from Vientiane to Hong Kong. So we'd go into Pak Se and have a little R&R, go up to Vientiane, make it on over to Hong Kong, and in those days, I guess we must have thought electronics was a pretty big deal, the giant tape recorders or even the little tape recorders, because in those times, in 63, the tape recorder was a big deal. They had a reel-to-reel, and these reels were only 3 inches big. Mm-hmm. So this is a wonderful thing. We got to get one of those. So it seems funny now, but that's what was in. Just the excitement of seeing something different like Hong Kong and the sights there. Took a tour of the new territories in Hong Kong, got over onto the China, I guess it was the China's new territories, and just tried to get a little bit of education while I was there. I had one trip I went to Angkor Wat, and of course, just visiting Angkor Wat, and brought a bunch of rice rubbings back with rice paper rubbings, just many different kinds of things. Many baskets. The Laotians were pretty good in arts and crafts, and I remember bringing baskets back, the sickles that they'd used to, the way they'd harvest their rice up on the hills, they'd get a big old bundle together in their hand, in their fist. They'd bring all these rice heads together in their fist, and then they'd take their sickle and pull on it, and it ended up with a bunch of rice, heads of rice, and they'd throw it in their basket that they had on their back, and that's the way they'd harvest the rice. So, water buffalo pulling the plow to till the soil. So we had a water buffalo pulling our plow, and our, I suspect it was about a 5-acre field of experimental corn project, and I forget what the other seeds were.
How did that do?
It worked out. It worked out. I was surprised the first time I'd ever done it, but I let an oxen pull my plow. I think I've got a picture of it somewhere around here, and it did all right. I was surprised. An oxen was willing to be obedient and stay in the furrow as we keep on plowing. And so that was exciting to me to see that this was possible. So, yeah, I remember when I first got there, the funerals were an unusual thing, too. Ethnic Lao along the Mekong River is where they mostly live, different than the Hill Tribe Lao. But when I first got there, the king of Laos had just died in 63. And don't know his name, but I remember this big ceremony of all these officials, government officials, Laotian government officials, holding this long rope, casket up front, long rope, and following this casket through Vientiane. Seemed like it was a good half mile long. I don't know. And then, of course, after that, that ceremony, there was a ceremony out on the soccer field. Someplace there was a soccer field there where they had a cremation, and that's where the cremation took place, and we all kind of, it was kind of a, I don't know, I guess you could call it a celebration party. It was food and dancing and that kind of thing. So, we went to some funerals up the Hill Tribe, a little different. They have a long line of people that follow the casket to the burial grounds, and up in the Hill Tribe, at least in Yohun and La Vin, they bury their people on top of the ground in a tightly sealed casket that they get the sealants from trees, and just bury it, and they build a little shelter, about a 6-7 foot high house, shall I say, over that casket. Casket's right there. Alongside the casket, you look in the window of the house or the opening, and there you'll see this person took their bicycle with them, took a little bit of money there, took a little, some of it, maybe some jewelry, things like that. You can still see them rested, but right there they are, and that kind of thing. So it was all very interesting to me to see this kind of, the culture and that kind of thing. So we had people wash our clothes. The person that cooked our food for us was a Chinese person. He also washed our clothes, things like that. So food was flown in every day, not every day, but we'd put in an order for whatever. And this was all done by airplane. The Helio would take our request for boards or timbers or food or what clothing, whatever we needed, to Paxay. Paxay would fly on the big DC-3 World War II planes up to Vientiane, and our IVS contact up there would supply us with what we put on our request, that kind of thing. So that's about for starters there. So yeah.
Well, one season follows another, and your 2 years are up.
2 years are up, and then it went awful fast.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Then it went fast, and then I headed back home. I guess at that point I was ready to, even though I enjoyed it, and I still wondered to this day whatever happened to some of those projects we started, and. But I went back to the States in 65, and finally, shortly after that, 66, made it out here to California. I had a degree in physical education. I think my thoughts were I was going to be a coach and teacher, and just eventually ended up not having enough whatever it takes to get into the public schools out here. I think you probably had to have about 5 years, and I had 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I came out and finally, I ended up working, got my first job down here in Elsinore, California, down in Riverside County, I guess it is, and teaching a juvenile bilingual boys home. And so that lasted, then I was able to, I was there for 1 year, then I ended up in Chino Unified School District because I heard they need teachers there, and they'll take them without, you know, credentials. So I ended up going there, and while I was teaching there for 4 years, that's where I met my wife. We married. She was a kindergarten teacher. I was a sixth grade teacher. And so basically worked my way into Cal State LA, things like that, and got my credential and decided at that point I'd really like to go into teaching, but maybe working with the handicapped. So that's what I'm doing to this very day. We went up to Oregon. She put me through up at the University of Oregon, got my credentials up there, and came back down here, got my job. Was an administrator a little while for LA County Schools in adaptive PE. Then money ran out when Prop 13 came along, and so I said, well, I'll go into the classroom. So that's what I'm doing to this day. I've been teaching, well, I guess for the past 10, 12 years in orthopedic handicap here in South Central Junior High. So, but I must say, I use some of these experiences. It's probably not more than a month goes by, but what I find myself bringing up some subject, be it in science or history, that had to do with Laos. And so I must say I'm thankful for the experience and that I had over there. And
how did you feel about the, you know, I mean, recently I was watching just another episode of Shelling in Kabul and having some fairly pleasant memories. It was always a wild place, but just watching something that was part of your life just becoming just one broken rock on top of another.
It's hard to take. It's hard to take that. I don't swallow that very easy. Yeah. Every time I see a picture of a Laotian, I've gotten to the point where it's, I can kind of differentiate by the clothing style. The dresses have those 8-inch borders along the bottom, and the men wear it with these special shirts. And I wonder, my heart goes out to, I'm not overly weepy or anything, but I that was the country I lived in, so I do care. And you don't like to see any destruction taking place, although I must say, since I've been back, I really try to keep track of IBS and read everything they send me. So if they ever say anything about Laos, I try to keep up on, or Vietnam or Cambodia. And I must say, I guess because I was a part of that culture only for 2 tiny years, but still, you like to see the best things happen over there. And,
Well, did you have any take on, I mean, I don't mean politically, but what was your reaction as you saw, I mean, after 65, the United States sent regular troops into South Vietnam, and it became an Americanized war, and Laos, of course, was always seen on the back burner. When you have a secret war, it's not like everyone knows what's going on.
I really felt bad. I first of all, I had a brother that was killed over there, and Nixon was the president, and I guess it could have been any president. It didn't matter who the president was. I just, it felt so, and the war was dragging on.